Welcome to Conversations with CEOs. I'm your host, Warren Zola, Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year to meet CEOs from around the world as they share their experiences and have a candid conversation. Robert Ford, President and CEO of Abbott Labs, joined me for a chat on the campus of Boston College. We discuss Abbott's role in developing rapid COVID in-home tests, how they're leading the way in connected healthcare to get closer to the patient and deliver results, what post-pandemic diagnostics will look like, and their high school internship program geared towards engaging young women to explore STEM careers. Welcome to everybody who's watching us on Zoom. As you can tell, this is a unique and first time that we've done this. We are now live without much of an audience in person, but we're thrilled to be here. And obviously, our guest, Robert Ford, CEO and President of Abbott, has joined me. So on behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, welcome to this session of Conversations with CEOs as we welcome Robert Ford, our guest, and most notably, a proud Boston College alum. So Robert, thank you for joining us here today, live in person at Boston College.
Thanks. This is great to be here and to do this live face-to-face. So I think it's great.
Yeah, it's really spectacular to be in person, to feel like we're headed towards normalcy. If everyone noticed, we were wearing our masks. We've both been tested very recently within the past day or so. We're going to keep our distance, but we are here together. The session will work the way all of our Zoom sessions has. This will run for 75 minutes. The first 30 minutes, Robert and I will engage in a conversation. Then we'll open it up to questions from our members and the audience. And then we'll finish it up with our lightning round and finish it up with a moment of hope. And we will be gone at 2:45. So once again, the protocol is the same as always, but we are just here live. I'm going to start. Robert, you joined Abbott Labs in 1996, became president in 2018, and then it was announced in 2019 that you would be following the footsteps of Miles White, and you assumed the reins in March of 2020 as CEO, which coincides with this pandemic. That must have been an interesting time for you to ascend to the position that you had earned in such a volatile and unique time. Tell me a little bit about what that was like.
Well, I can say that I think everybody had a sense of, oh my God, what's going on, over at least for the first 3 months. Everybody kind of got caught up with that. But listen, I would say it's been an amazing experience for the first year. If I think about kind of what kind of gets us through in a situation like that, I'd say first, I was handed over a company that was in amazing shape, incredible shape. We had great products, great people, great culture. So when you get into a situation like that, starting off at a really good strong spot was super important. I guess the second part also is. You're only as good as you are as your team, and I had an incredible team during this period of transition, from support of the board to all the people in the C-suite to the people out in the field. So we really came together as one. So I think that was a huge advantage to kind of have that level of commitment and belief in the purpose and the moment of being called upon as a company, right, as a healthcare company. And then finally, I'd say family support. I think for all of us that had to work long hours, have a completely different work environment, personal, coming together with business, all of that coming all together and really not having a distinction between what's family time, what's business time. So I had incredible support from my wife, my two boys. So I think the combination of those things really helped it be a pretty spectacular year and a year of a lot of learnings.
And I mean, it must have been remarkable in the sense of, we've been fortunate. We've talked to a lot of CEOs during the past, 18 months, and talking about leadership and leading and change and learning how to operate from home and virtual environments and all that sort of stuff. But as you mentioned, you're leading a global healthcare company. Here's a company that's on the front lines, developing tests, protocols. This isn't just something waiting for people to respond and address the pandemic that we're in. You're out there saying we got to be part of the solution immediately. And this is your first 100 days in that chair. That must have been, was that added pressure in any way, or just because you had a great team, you were comfortable?
Well, obviously there's a lot of pressure, but it's, you know, the pressure of really recognizing that this is the time where Abbott is being called upon, you know, a company that's been around in, for about over 130 years, solving a lot of healthcare problems, a lot of healthcare issues. Now you're confronted with probably the biggest healthcare crisis of our generation. So no doubt pressure, but I think the purpose and the mission is as to why we're here. I spoke a lot to employees about, you know, that these were the times that Abbott gets called upon. This is why we're built for these moments. And I think that was kind of galvanizing for a lot of people. They really understood that this was time for Abbott to step up, as did a lot of healthcare companies.
Yeah, it you know, you weren't by yourself having to address everything, but your company needed to take a leading role in helping address and figure out how to test and everything else. And that led you to create and made available. Now you have the Binax Now COVID-19 rapid test. It's received emergency use authorization from the FDA, and it's now an at-home test. Tell us a little bit more about this product that you are so proud of and your company should be so proud of.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is Binax is part of a suite of products. We actually developed 11 different tests for not only detecting the virus, so PCR methodology. I think we're all experts now in PCR, which I think is great, but also rapid molecular testing, which kind of does the same thing as what PCR is doing, but just at a more rapid pace, less throughput, more rapid result. And then we developed a series of antigen tests. Binax is one of them. We have another test for the international markets called PanBio, and it uses similar technology. And then the antibody tests, also important in that. So we really looked at our suite of diagnostic testing solutions and said, okay, we know that the virus has its life cycle, and we want to make sure that we've got testing solutions across the full spectrum, whether you're testing at a hospital, at an urgent care clinic, at a university, at the workplace, et cetera. So Binax was an interesting project because it actually started back in middle of April, where we said to ourselves, you know, we need to develop a test that was going to help schools reopen. If you remember, we had all gone on shutdown, and not a lot of people were talking about the schools, but we knew that come July that this was going to be an issue. What are schools going to do to get back? And we didn't want the default to automatically be, we'll just go virtual for the fall. So we wanted to develop a test. And there were three key tenets to that development of that test. We wanted it to be reliable and at the same time easy to use. So it's a lateral flow technology. It's a technology that we use for HIV testing, malaria testing, Legionella, flu, et cetera. And it resembles a lot like a pregnancy test. You put a sample on this paper, the sample travels up this special paper, and it provides a result in the form of two lines, one line, et cetera. And pretty simple, easy to use. The reliability of the test is measured by its sensitivity as compared to like a PCR system is very good in that period where you're infectious. So between 2 and 7 to 10 days, it's got a correlation to a lab instrument of about, you know, between 85 and 95%. And there's been plenty of studies that have published this. So very reliable result, easy to use. So you don't have to use the nasal pharyngeal swab, which is all the way at the back. And when you think about kids going back to school, we thought that was going to be important. So it only uses a nasal swab, which is just kind of right in the beginning, in the front part of the nose. And you don't need an instrument, right? So it's much easier to deploy. So that was one key tenet, and Binax delivers on that. The second key thing we looked at was scale. And we knew that we were going to need a lot of tests. You can't, you know, we set a pretty audacious target of having 50 million tests by June 15th. This was in the middle of April. And the amount of work that the Abbott team did to be able to set up new factories, new supply chains here in the U.S., we ended up missing that goal. We ended up delivering it in August, but still to do what we did in 4 months was pretty amazing. And what that scale allows you to then do is to do what's important, which is price it for access and affordability. If you're going to use this test on a routine basis, you don't want to be paying $200 every time you do it. So that allowed us to get to a cost profile of about $5, right? And then the third thing we wanted to make sure we did is we wanted to digitize it. We wanted to make sure that you could use your phone to be able to display your results. So what we did is we created an app called Navica. And what the Navica app does is you can download it for free. And what it does is it pairs the test to your phone so that you can receive your result on your phone. You don't have to wait around. And more importantly, it's a pass that says I was tested and I'm negative. So we were able to align all those three things and come out with that test with all those three aspects in August. And then in December, as you mentioned, we got approval to do all of that on a at-home basis. So we've partnered with a digital telehealth company called eMed. And what they do is they use these tests. So we ship these tests you can actually do the test with a digital proctor on the other side on the computer, not only showing you how to do the test right, but then they're the ones who actually input into your app whether you're negative or positive. So you actually have integrity in the system. So that test is, has worked very well. It's been deployed across the U.S. We've deployed it in international markets also. We've got a significant amount of capacity to be able to execute that strategy around the world.
So walk me through this then. And again, for those of you who are joining us a little bit late, I am here with Robert Ford, CEO of Abbott and a proud Boston College alum who has decided to come back to campus, socially distanced as we may be, but to be live together in front of an empty theater, which is a unique experience, certainly for me. But we are here, and Robert's talking to us about this COVID-19 at-home test that has developed. And you mentioned the term audacious as a goal for June delivery. You missed that, but hit it in August, which I think is impressive. You got FDA conditional approval or emergency approval in December. So walk me through. I'm now sitting at home, and I'm interested in getting one of these, taking the test. So this is something that am I able to purchase this today as a consumer?
So you can purchase it online through our partner eMed. Okay. They will eventually hopefully become available at the pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And we're also working with different governors from different states in which they will also be providing those tests. But I think the goal here is eventually that you'll be able to do a test at home with integrity, meaning that there's somebody on the other side that's watching you do it correctly and getting the right results.
So I take the test at home, I log on to eMed, I've got someone through video who's watching me do this, I take the test, I know what the results are, but I give them to eMed, eMed loads them up, I have it on my phone, and now if I want to go somewhere, I've got proof of a test within a percentage of reliability that you've mentioned already. And this is being used commercially already. I think is this something?
Yeah, this is available today through an at-home system. It's also available today through a lot of the states and a lot of the governors. A lot of the governors have been using these tests, deploying them to K-12 schools. We've seen companies, workplace to be able to use this. We, in fact, use the same technology at Abbott. So we get tested twice a week and go through the same process. What's interesting is we work obviously with healthcare professionals as we do that testing. But our positivity rates, even at the peak of the fall and the winter, our positivity rates in our facilities were generally lower than the positivity rates around the surrounding area, which really shows the importance of testing to be able to identify cases and then let them quarantine at home.
And how does it work for the new sort of variants that people are starting to discover, uncover, identify? Is it picking that up as well, or is it something that you'll be updating the testing itself over time?
Yeah. So when we developed the test, we've got a lot of experience in infectious disease testing. Abbott was the first company to develop the first blood test for HIV back in the mid 80s. So we have a really capable team. So we knew that as we were developing the test, we had to target specific areas of the virus that we knew would be less susceptible to variants. And we've done a lot of in silico modeling to show that even with the South Africa variant, the Brazilian variant, and the UK variant, that the test is has that same sensitivity. And we've actually received samples from those countries and run them on our tests. The UK system tested our product, came back with a public report saying that the tests were very good at picking up those variants. So we stay vigilant. We have a team at Abbott called the Virus Hunters. They've been in business for, unfortunately, for some time, and they know how to chase viruses, and they know how to chase variants. So I'm super confident that we've got the right team, constantly vigilant, looking at this.
The Abbott Virus Hunters. It sounds like a new Netflix documentary that I can watch in and binge over the weekend.
There you go. Yeah, that's maybe an idea right there.
Yeah, fantastic. We'll make sure that the proceeds find their way to Boston College. In a broader perspective, right? Abbott has been leading the charge on connected healthcare, trying to get closer to the patients, and the COVID testing that you've developed is just one arm of all sorts of innovations that Abbott has led in terms of technologies. You've addressed everything from heart failure to type 1 diabetes to chronic pain, movement disorders, recently approval for the first ever handheld blood test to detect traumatic brain injuries such as concussions. Could you give us a little bit of detail on some of these innovations and how you see patients' lives improving because of them and the great work of your employees and colleagues at Abbott?
Yeah, so it's clear that you see this convergence of healthcare and digital technology happening. They're coming together, and there are a variety of different ways to look at how that convergence is ultimately going to play a role. What we've tried to do is we've tried to use that convergence with a lot of our products to ultimately, we believe that connectivity will allow the consumer to have better insights and be more empowered to managing their health. So we started this several years back with our medical device portfolio. And as you said, we have a portfolio of products that range from cardiovascular treatment to neuromodulation and diabetes, et cetera, where a lot of these devices get implanted into the body. And there's not a lot of information that comes out of that device to the consumer. So connecting those devices to your phone and in a way that provides the lay consumer with actionable, easy to understand information about their device and ultimately about their body. That's what we've set out to do, and the results are incredible. If you look at our diabetes glucose monitoring device, Freestyle Libre, that's connected to the phone, and the traditional way of doing it is you prick your finger and you get that one result during that one time. Now with Libre, what you get is a constant stream of data. And you get to see on your phone patterns, and you get to see them clearly. You know, one of the things that we've always heard is nobody knew what happened at night. You know, nobody was waking up at 2, 3 a.m. in the morning to prick their fingers. Not a lot of people, at least. But if you wake up in the morning and you take your phone and you scan it, the first thing you do before you get out of bed, you'll be able to see the last 8 hours and what happened overnight. And the insights that provides the physician, for sure, but more importantly, the consumer and the patient, they can see what's happening to their body. Diabetes is one example. Heart failure with CardioMEMS is another product where we do that. Our pacemakers are doing that. We just launched a product called Gallant that interacts with your phone via Bluetooth. So I'm a big believer of that, and Abbott is leading the way there. And we took that same philosophy as we started to develop the diagnostic test and applied that in the concept of Navica. So we're going to lead the way in that connectiveness, and you'll see that across all of our products.
So as Abbott leads the way, what will sort of post-pandemic diagnostic look like, right? Are you expecting all sorts of companies to be following this suit, and so everything's going to be more connected? It's going to be more stuff that you're doing at home. What do you see? Will this pandemic sort of shape how diagnostic testing is where the future of diagnostic testing, I guess, is a poorly worded question, but
I think that what you'll see is, and what we believe we'll see, is a new channel of diagnostic testing emerge. I don't think it'll be a channel that will, you know, compete or take patients away from the hospital. Right now, a lot of our diagnostic testing is done in that setting, the hospital, the lab, and that will continue. But I think what will happen on the other hand is with these technologies that are out there, Binex, ID Now, which is a kind of rapid molecular test, the ability for you to be able to get your results faster and easier and have it on your phone, I think is going to be a trend. So we talk about, you know, the decentralization, the democratization, and the digitization of testing. And I think that's a strategy that, you know, we believed was going to be the case. We bought a company back in 2017 who had a large round of products that fit into this category. And I think what COVID has done is just accelerated that strategy and brought that forward, you know, several years. So right now, as we're seeding the market with COVID testing, we have our eye on, okay, what does that word look like? So if you think about, you know, the channels, for example, you know, you have airports doing testing, you have hotels doing testing, you even have restaurants doing testing. And I don't think that they're going to be trying to compete with laboratories doing testing, but it'll be a new channel that'll emerge. It'll be a new behavior that'll emerge. Everything we're doing with COVID and seeding that market is really with the eye on what is that going to look like for other tests. So we have flu tests, we have RSV tests, we have sexual transmitted disease tests. So all these other tests will then kind of fall into these channels that have emerged.
So is this going to be Orwellian in the sense of you're going out to dinner in the future and you've got your phone to showcase, here's everything I've been cleared of from the flu to COVID to everything else? Or is it just more an opportunity for the consumer to have more information at their hands?
Yeah, I think it's more just having information at your hands. All right. I don't think you're going to have to go to a restaurant and say, hey, I've been cleared for flu. There are places around the world that actually do require you to show that to be able to go into the restaurant. Right. But I don't think it's the case. I just think it's more the case of I want to know this information, and I want to know it now, and I want it on my phone. I want to be able to interact with it digitally and real time. And I think that the channels that will emerge will allow that to happen.
Does that open up a host of privacy questions in terms of having all that data sort of on the phone? Is that anything that Abbott's concerned with, or is that something that you'll let the technology companies deal with, sort of the protocols and
Well, no, I mean, I think there's, as a healthcare company, HIPAA and privacy is been with us, whether you're using your phone or whether you're using an electronic medical record. So that has to be embedded into all the digital solutions that are created.
I'm going to change the tact a little bit and talk a little bit about some bigger picture issues about at Abbott, but I do want to remind our audience that we will open it up to questions from our members at 2 o'clock. So if you've got questions, please post them in the chat or the Q&A, and I will be notified here on stage who's up next for the first question when we get going with that. But congratulations to Abbott. For the first time, you've been named one of the world's 50 most admired companies in Fortune magazine annual ranking as chosen by the business world. You've also been recognized for the 8th straight year as one of the most admired companies in your industry group. Something that obviously you're proud of? Is it something that has been part of the core values of the company over time? Is it something that you think your leadership has played any role in?
No, I mean, we're obviously very proud. This is not something that we wake up every day saying, hey, we want to be part of this list or that list. I think what's special about the Forbes list is that it's a voting of your peers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably what makes it special, is that these are your peers that look to you and say, well, this is a company that's been doing some groundbreaking stuff. I just think it's part of our culture of developing life-changing technologies and helping people live fuller lives, and doing everything you can to do that. And to be recognized by your peers as being one of the best at doing that, I think that's special. But this has been, you know, Abbott has been, you know, being part of these rankings for quite some time now. So I would never take credit for that. I think it's really the Abbott people that are really what drive that.
Excellent. Today is International Women's Day. So I do want to mention that in 2012, you started a high school internship program, or Abbott did, towards engaging young women to explore STEM careers. Can you tell us a little bit about this program? And it's been going now for 9 years. How is it going? What sort of impact have you had?
I think this is one of our best programs. I think the problem here was recognizing the need for more STEM. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics here in the U.S., it forecasts we need over 800,000 STEM workers by 2029. And studies showed that between the ages of 13 and 17, children lost interest in STEM. So, and you know, both boys and girls, but especially girls. And we wanted to make sure that we reached out to the children in that period, in that continuum of education, to ensure that they didn't lose interest in it. So we created this internship program that was geared towards high school students. It was started in 2012. And these are real STEM related work. It's not getting coffee or filing work. It's real work. They get paid for it, and I think the results have been great. If you look at the people that have gone through, the kids that have gone through this program, 97% of them go on to study STEM in college and in universities. This last class that we did, 70% of the class that was enrolled was from diverse backgrounds. And about 75%, we started to hire the former children that went through the first program back in 2012. We're hiring them as full-time engineers to work at Abbott. And 75% of them are either women or from diverse backgrounds. So I think this is a great program. We actually made the program available. We called it Shape the Future of STEM, and we put the blueprint out and how we did this program, and we made it public on our website, and it's been downloaded, you know, by hundreds of companies in the S&P 500, technology, healthcare, etc. We think it's a great program, and it's really focused at ensuring that kids don't lose interest in something that, you know, they, when they were a little bit younger, felt compelled by it. So to keep that passion going, so we're proud of that program.
That's fantastic. I mean, the thought of doing something good, making the world better, educating, and then reaping the benefits in many ways of having the opportunity to hire some of these kids, young adults now, to have them sort of be that next round and keep this virtuous cycle going must just be fantastic.
It's super special to know that kids that went through this internship program back in 2012, 2013, are actually now coming into every day to the office to do this work on a full-time basis. I think that's super special.
That's fantastic. So I think we're at the point in our time where I'm going to open it up to our members for their questions. With luck, we will be able to unmute your microphone, and we will hear your question through the speakers here in this empty theater. The first person who's up is Liz Bruner. So Liz, with any luck, we'll be able to hear you and you can ask your question of Robert.
Hello, can you hear me? Let's start with that.
Yes, we can.
Excellent, thank you so much. And Robert, first and foremost, thank you for joining us and thank you for all the great work that you and your team are doing at Abbott. It really is quite impressive, not only with COVID, but also just in the healthcare industry in general. You mentioned that you had developed the rapid COVID tests and the at-home test, and you also mentioned that your company has the antibody tests. And I'm curious, do you plan to have or do you have an at-home antibody test? That's question one. And question two, what is Abbott's research and philosophy on how long you have antibodies if you have had COVID-19?
So the first part of that question is we do have antibody tests here in the U.S. For lab instruments. So we've been supplying hospitals, laboratories with that kind of test. And the at-home, let's call it pregnancy, like, you know, put a drop of blood on the rapid test. We have that test in international markets, and we are developing a rapid test for antibodies here in the U.S., actually globally, that really targets the protein of that's produced of the antibody that's more specific to somebody that's being vaccinated. So so stay tuned. Team is working on that. And then your second question, sorry, was?
Well, it's about the research that Abbott has done. Once somebody has had COVID, for example, there have been many different reports that you probably have a natural immunity for 90 days, maybe up to 8 months. And I'm curious if Abbott has any research and information on your approach and philosophy on that.
Well, I think there's still a lot of studying to be done on this virus. You know, there are studies that talk about the immunity lasting naturally after you've had it for a while. There are studies that have showed that, you know, you can get reinfected after you now have variants going on there. So I would say there's a lot of studying going on right now, and I think that's right, and I think that's good. But I think it's difficult to make a definitive statement that says, listen, you know, if you've had it, you have a natural immunity that's built in you. We just don't know how long that lasts. From a virology standpoint, yes, you build antibodies. The question is, how long is it going to naturally last? I think the studies about the vaccines are pretty amazing in terms of the protection that they've added. So I think there's going to be more and more studying that's going to go on regarding antibodies, vaccines, natural immunity. There's such a thing called T cell immunity. So you might test negative for antibodies of the virus, but you actually have T cell immunity, and that's a whole other different type of test that exists also. So I think bottom line here, there's just a lot more testing that needs to be done. And it's not to take results as a grain of salt. It's just, we're still learning a lot. I mean, this was, you know, the term novel virus is because we hadn't seen it. So there's a lot of studying going on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liz, for that question. Folks, reminder, ask questions on the chatter Q&A, and we will find a way to, time permitting, get them to Robert. Next up is Segun Adowu. Segun, hopefully your microphone is on and you can ask your question of Robert.
Thank you very much. This is actually my first of these chats, and I'm happy I attended this one. I learned a lot and appreciate the work that you're doing over at Abbott to make our community safer and healthier. So I'm the president of a group called BECMA, Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. It advocates for Black businesses here in the Commonwealth. And one of the things we've been thinking about this year is about the digital divide. And you mentioned that a lot of your products kind of rely on Bluetooth capabilities. So I'm wondering if Abbott has taken a position or is doing any work to support others in the community that are focused on closing that digital divide so that all of our communities have access to the types of tools that you've made available?
Yeah, that's super important to us. We do realize that, you know, the phone is an incredible tool, but not everybody, you know, has access to that phone. So a lot of these connected procedures that I'm referring to, we actually provide. So for example, for some of our neuromodulation stimulation devices, so these are devices where they connect to a phone and they provide pain relief for, you know, people that have kind of back pains, et cetera. And we realize that, you know, the benefit of the closed system with the phone is really where the power lies. And so we provide those phones, those devices free of charge to those that don't have phones. But I think this is something that, you know, we're all going to have to work on together to make sure that, you know, the ability to digitally connect these devices to a phone. And sometimes the connection to the phone just provides access to better care. So for example, some of the defibrillating devices that we have that connect to a phone, they can actually send information to the hospital with algorithms that say, okay, this patient needs to get to a hospital pretty quickly before something happens. So I agree with your statement. It's not fully equitable, let's call it that way. But we're trying our best to make sure that as we develop these, that those that don't have access to the phone, that we are actually able to provide the phone.
Wonderful. Thank you, Segun, and thank you for joining us both in general and today with our guest, Robert Ford of Abbott. Next up is Peter Bell. Peter is another proud Boston College alum. So, Peter, it's great to hear from you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Warren, and thank you, Robert, for doing this. for the BC CEO Club, but and congrats on the success you've had at Abbott and the importance of Abbott in our world. My question really, I talked to a lot of BC students, both current students and recent alums, and many are obviously interested in healthcare being such an important part of our society and economy. And I love what you guys have done around high school internships and the future of STEM program. Just maybe talk broadly, not just about Abbott, but just as you maybe talk to young people, maybe BC students that want to get into a great business like Abbott or the healthcare industry, what are the skills they should be developing both while they're at BC and in their early parts of their careers to make them, you know, I guess, valued employees at a company like Abbott?
Thanks. I think that, I mean, we could talk about some of the specific skills. I would say before skills is just the realization of the special nature of the work that you do in healthcare. I consider, and I say this to a lot of Abbott people, we're the lucky ones. If you believe that you are lucky to be able to do what we're doing to help people live better lives, fuller lives, you know, I think that's like the first part of it. It's a bug, it's a bite that you get. And once you're exposed to it for the first time, interact with a patient that, you know, you've had a profound impact on their life, on their family's life. I think that's the first step. So I would say anything that allows you to get exposure to that in a way, I think is super important. I was exposed to that. I didn't expect to be working in healthcare out of BC, and I started working for a company, and I got exposed to that, and I was able to see exactly, you know, the kind of impact that those products that I was working on was having, and I think that was special. Specifically to skill sets, I mean, you can look at variety of different things. I mean, if you're an engineer, and building those skill sets and capabilities, the digital side, marketing and commercial, regulatory, I think is super important skill set to understand, understanding how to navigate the regulatory environment, both in the US and internationally also. So I think there are skills that you can learn. I learned a lot of skills at BC that I've used in the healthcare industry, but I guess I would just go back to the beginning. If you can get exposed to the kind of impact that the products have on people's lives, I think that is lasting and is sufficient. Listen, I think it's cool to do apps. I think it's cool to do all these great new technologies, but I think it's pretty cool to save lives, and that's what I tell. That's what I tell younger people.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Peter, for bringing this back to big picture and reminding the students to think holistically. Hopefully something that they learn here at Boston College, and to save lives is a nice goal in terms of your career, right? There's none better. Speaking of saving lives, our next guest is Dr. Tony Coles. Tony, it's great to hear from you. And for those who remember, Tony was the first person that we did a conversation with CEO on Zoom under the pandemic. I think it was in May of 2020. And Tony gave us his perspective on what the future would look like. So it's great to hear from you again. And the floor is yours, Tony.
Well, thank you, Warren. And Robert, thank you for coming to chat with us today. I want to pick up on the thread of a couple of things you talked about. One was your last set of comments around the importance of transforming lives through what we do in the healthcare industry. I'm the chairman and the CEO for Cerevel Therapeutics, a neuroscience discovery and development company. So I guess given that we're living this unusual moment in time when all eyes are focused on the healthcare industry and the expectation that we will literally change the face of this pandemic. The first question is, what do you think is the most important business challenge facing healthcare today, outside of the pandemic, of course, and how and why is Abbott uniquely prepared to face it? There's a second question, which is, given your great work on the STEM program for minorities, can you discuss Abbott's internal and external record addressing the social justice issues that obviously affect your workers, but have also been a part of the national dialogue recently? Many business leaders have stood in the gap in this conversation, and I think our listeners would be very interested to hear how Abbott has filled that gap.
Sure. So I think one of the biggest challenges that we have, I mean, there's a lot in healthcare, but I think the biggest one we face is that of access and affordability. My view is that we make this incredible life-changing products and technologies and services, and we've gotten a slight glimpse of what can happen to our healthcare system globally in the next 10 years if we don't think differently as an industry. And I'm not just talking, you know, companies like Abbott. I'm talking companies also in the service areas also. We got a little bit of a glimpse in this pandemic of what it could be. A lot of our shutdown obviously was driven because of, you know, fear of contagion and death. But a lot of the shutdown was also driven by healthcare systems, and we didn't want the system to be overrun. So as you look at the challenge in the next 10 years, we're going to have a lot more people, a lot more money being spent in healthcare, a lot more people living longer, and the challenge of providing health and health services to a lot of people. So I think one of the things that needs to change is that we're very good at solving the medical and the clinical problem. And we've been doing that for decades. And it's had marvels of science and innovation of what we've been able to do. And we need to continue to do that. But at the same time now, we have to look at solving the issue of access and affordability together with the clinical and medical issue. And that means designing in your innovation process and ensuring that in your design phase and your innovation process that you are including how can we do this and use technology in a way that lowers the cost so that you can make the solution much more broader than what it currently is today. A lot of our solutions are niche-y. Meaning that they cover a certain group of people, and we need to make sure that the innovation is more broader. And I think that's a challenge for healthcare companies and the industry to think how do we go from thinking about a specific disease to be able to think a little bit more mass, because I think that's going to be our biggest challenge. As it relates to your question on diversity, you know, this was a topic that got a lot of attention, rightfully so, should get attention. It was good to see a lot of the companies, start to put in plans or announce plans to make an action. I think what's going to be important is that the companies follow through with those. I could speak for Abbott. Diversity is the heart of who we've been over the last 30 years. Diversity in our products, in where we operate, I think we've done a good job. But there's so much more that we can do and that we have to do. And we have a team that is not, it's a team that's helping us across the entire company look at how we can provide more opportunities for development, more opportunities for challenge across a greater variety of people with different backgrounds. And I think having the experience of different backgrounds makes a company much more richer. Have we made progress? Yeah, I think we have. Are where we need to be now? No, we're not. We know that. We know we need to work harder. But it's across the entire leadership team on understanding that this is something that we're going to be focused on. And you actually have to spend time. You have to spend time talking to people. You have to spend time thinking about solutions. And you have to be involved.
Tony, any follow-up?
Sorry, I was trying to get myself off mute. No, I think, look, I agree that the first set of answers, I completely agree with access and affordability will be important both for the laboratory diagnostic and device businesses that you run and for the drug development businesses for sure. And that is something that we as an industry have to step to and step to very, very quickly. The second part of the question, though, I guess I just love if there's any more detail, it sounds as though the challenges we have in this country regarding systemic and structural racism and what's happened, I think really do require specific solutions. So I don't know if you're at liberty to talk at all about how you're thinking about that specifically, both either internally or externally, but that would, I think, would be a good potential exemplar for our listeners?
Yeah, listen, one of the things that I learned as I was talking to teams is Abbott is a very, is a culture of achievement. So we give ourselves some tough goals, some tough aspirations, and we hold ourselves accountable to them. I think one of the challenges that one faces when you have a team, or when you've been tasked to do something that's pretty lofty, aspirational, is you don't want to fail, at least not an Abbott. So you try to surround yourself with people that you've been in the foxhole before, people that you understand, okay, they've been tested, and I know that they've come through, right? And I think the problem with that is that it creates kind of like these bubbles, right? Like, this is the team that I know that I can kind of trust on. And so I don't necessarily think it's a specific issue of racism. I think it's just an issue of, like, you need to open up because there's incredible talent in the company that you can add on to the team, and they'll bring a different perspective, and you need to be able to give that opportunity. So specifically, we're working on making sure that we're uncovering that talent, that we're highlighting that talent, and we're making sure that as we look at promotions, as we look at team forming, that we know whether these team members are being considered for those assignments, and we're asking ourselves, well, why not this person? There's never a good answer. It's always like, well, we didn't think of it, so let's give it a shot. And I think that's the first step.
Great. Thank you, Robert.
Wonderful. And thank you, Tony, for the questions and for all of your support of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. I think I'm going to mention at this point right now, since we still are open for questions from our members, as a reminder, our next event will be on April 5th, where we're going to be speaking about PwC's CEO Action for Diversity and Inclusion Initiative, where Tim Ryan, the chairman and senior partner of PwC, will be joined by Jenny Johnson, president and CEO of Franklin Templeton, and Wright Lassiter, president and CEO of the Henry Ford Health System. So we will have a panel discussion on this Action for Diversity and Inclusion Initiative that PwC has announced and been engaging with for some time now at our next event on Zoom on April 5th. But I'm going to turn back to you, Robert, as a CEO, and not as a husband or father, but as a CEO, what is it that keeps you up at night now, thinking about where we're going and what sort of is in store for you coming up in the next couple of months? Is there anything particular that you're thinking, boy, this is the one thing that I'm continuing to sort of give thought to that is causing me to lose some sleep?
Yeah, I think probably in the last 6 months, a lot of the thinking was the sleepless nights were, you know, the ramping up of the testing and making sure that we were doing what we needed to do, you know, ensuring that our employees were safe. I mean, I can imagine that a lot of the people on the call here went through that same challenge, and ensuring that people are safe as they go back to work, and a lot of the work there, ensuring that we don't lay off people that we don't need to lay off. In fact, during the pandemic, we hired an additional 5,000 people. So I think that was very positive. I'd say as we switch out of that, you know, it's more about thinking how COVID is changing, how COVID is changing the workplace. I mean, there's a lot of different viewpoints on the future of the workplace, et cetera. I also think about, you know, the digitization and that connectedness that we talk about. How is COVID going to change? How is it going to change how we care for people? I think telemedicine, telehealth is going to be a huge new area that's been drastically accelerated. So those are the kind of bigger strategic things that are keeping me up at night.
And that all makes sense to me. And it's funny for you to talk about sort of this digitization in virtual healthcare. Apparently today on your website, Neurosphere was announced that this is a virtual clinic that can you tell us a little bit more about that? I'm getting this as someone's texting me, hey, ask about this. So I'm asking you about this. Your website's live. Tell us a little bit about.
Sure. This is an amazing accomplishment from the team. So this comes from our neuromodulation business. And neuromodulation, for those that don't know, they use electricity to stimulate the nerves to do a variety of different things to deal with pain or even to deal with movement disorders. So one of the things that we learned is there's a technology that we call deep brain stimulation, and this is putting leads into your brain, and you stimulate with electrical impulses, specific areas of the brain to address movement disorders like Parkinson's disease, et cetera. There's probably about 170 centers around the world that do this. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of people that live far, far away. So when they need to come back into the hospital to get reprogrammed, it was a difficulty challenge. So what NeuroSphere is going to eventually be able to do is going to allow a physician in his office to remote program the configuration of those devices that stimulate, in this case, the brain, but even the lower back, et cetera, or the spinal cord. Be able to stimulate it without the patient having to come in into the clinic to be able to do that. And this is the first app within this category that's been able to do that. We worked together with the FDA to be able to kind of submit and make sure that everything we needed to do was done. So this is going to be exciting. Yeah,
that's fascinating. I mean, it's when you think about the last 18 months, both the public's appetite for recognizing that they can turn to their computer and have live stream video engagement is something that is sort of this tipping point, right? It was something that was technology, it was available before. I teach, and it never occurred to me that I might have to teach via Zoom for the fall semester, which I did, and it was a joy. But it was also something that now is changing the way people have access. But it also speaks to Tony's question about who has that availability, who has the Wi-Fi and the access and the computer and the recognition of here it is. But it seems like that world is getting smaller, if you will. The world is flat and we're all getting closer. And this technology, as access is available, now provides opportunity for both the consumer and for the companies that are able to deliver.
Yeah, I there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make it more more broadly available. But I think it's always a good you got to start somewhere, and I'm glad that we're trying to take this position here of trying to empower the consumer more with their information, because I think an empowered consumer allows them to make better decisions. I mean, a lot of this stuff is behavior modification, right? And if you could see it in front of you, it has a different impact.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is interesting for me to sort of think about how this is changing the way we operate now, just sort of in general, right? And so, you know, Boston College gets 12 inches of snow, and instead of not having to teach that day, it's congratulations, you're now going to be on Zoom. It's this adaptation of we've now endured and learned, and here's how we're applying it to change behavior moving forward to make the world smaller and closer, right?
Yeah, I think that the only danger, though, that I see is that we go, you know, the pendulum swings over too much, right? I think that it's important to use this technology to understand that, hey, we can be more virtual, but I'm a big believer of collaboration. I think Abbott is at its best when we collaborate, when we're face-to-face, when we're problem-solving together. And when you're on 8 hours of back-to-back Zooms, you know, you don't, you know, as soon as that meeting's over, you're on to the other. There's no, like, there's no conversation for 5 minutes. Hey, what do you think of this kind of thing? And I think that's super important. And I think we've got to be careful to not all of a sudden swing all the other way. I think face-to-face is super important. And I could say for Abbott, it's who we are. We're at our best when we're doing what we're doing like that.
You do not have to convince me. I run an organization that is based on networking and connections and relationships. And while we're thrilled to have you here on stage, we're in an empty auditorium, and I prefer to be at the Boston Harbor Hotel with 300 of our members, having those impromptu conversations, those discussions, the here's my business card, let's connect again later. And so I think that the technology has allowed us to stay connected, but is not a replacement for those tangible personal relationships that we've developed over time. So with that, I am now going to turn it to our exciting lightning round of questions. And these I think are fun and personal, and I know our members like them. I'm going to start off with, I know you're born Brazil with your mom being American and your dad Brazilian, and you grew up in Brazil. How has that sort of shaped you, your perspective, your global take on things? Has that played a role in sort of who you are today?
Yeah, 100%. I lived in a very, I'd say, kind of diverse kind of background family, and in a country where I I had Brazilian friends, I had Brazilian culture, and then I would mix that in with American culture. My mom always made sure that, you know, we had Thanksgiving every Thursday, and, you know, but it wasn't the Thanksgiving we know here. It was just a meal at night on Thursday. But yeah, that definitely shaped me, being able to have that broader perspective and have a variety of different friends with different kind of backgrounds. Yeah, 100%.
And who do you root for in the World Cup then?
Come on, Warren, you should know that answer.
Very good. Thank you. What was your first paying job?
My first paying job, I actually worked a lot in Brazil on farms with cattle and horses, but my first paying job was right here. I don't think the building exists anymore. I can't remember the name of it, but it was right down here in Lower Campus. And my job was to call alumni and ask them for money. that was my first job. Was placing those calls, and I remember, since I was new, I would get the recently graduated, which were always the best ones to make the calls.
That's fantastic. It would have been at Moore Hall, I think, was the building.
Okay, that's it. Yeah,
they had an advancement or an alumni office,
but that building's not here anymore.
No, it's been replaced by a brand new dorm.
Yeah. Okay.
But I remember going to those phone banks myself as a student and filling in to make some of those phone calls myself.
And then my other job, and I think it's still here, is the sandwich shop right across. Used to be Maddie's, the roll sandwich. So when they opened up the Rollwich sandwich store, that was where I used to work also.
It's still there, and Maddie's has changed names.
I know.
And I was mentioning to you off stage beforehand, they sell one of your products over there for the college students. It's with Pedialyte as something that has found its way to college campuses.
Adult hydration. Just excellent. Important. Yeah.
What was the last book that you read?
You know, I sometimes you get asked this question, and I'm not a big book reader. So I lean myself more towards magazine, newspaper reading. So it's your kind of triad there of HBR, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times. I prefer reading that kind of format. So
it's keeping yourself current, up to date with management, leadership techniques and skills.
Well, there's that. There's politics. I mean, you know, you can have your array there. So I try to that's where I focus more. I don't have a cool book to recommend. I'm sorry. I could, you know, maybe I should like have a book so I can always answer the question. I'm more of a newspaper and magazine reader.
I just read this, you know, 3,000 tome biography of this fantastic Brazilian philosopher
deep
from the 12th century. Nothing like that. No. Okay. Fair enough. What was the last song or album that you intentionally listened to that you went out of your way and said, this is something that I'd like to listen to? Is music part of something that you have in the background, or you just flip on the, you know, series? Is there any particular channel? Just anything that you listen to a lot?
I was walking my dog. I like to walk my dog on the weekends, and it's a great time to either kind of listen to podcasts or just listen to music. So I think it was a Pink Floyd album, Animals, was what I listened to on Sunday. It's great melodic instrumentation. That was Sunday.
And the obvious question that I know our members would love to hear, what type of dog, what's their name? I mean,
Black Lab Apollo.
Apollo the Black Lab, and you're listening to Pink Floyd. I can picture this on a Saturday morning, and you're walking around thinking, this is what I finally made it, right?
But. You know, it's we all have our things.
Absolutely. I have an Alaskan Malamute, and so she's finally able in the winter and the snow to get out and enjoy herself and go for the walk. So I understand that choosing the music or a podcast and getting out there. So favorite guilty food?
I'm carnivorous, so as kind of a good Brazilian. So, but I've been told that I got to slow down on the red meat. So that's why it falls into the guilty bucket now.
Okay, but you know, growing up in Brazil, you said you worked out with cattle. Is this is.
Just, you know, as part of the experiences I had and life experiences I had. But no, it's the Brazilian barbecue. Anybody who's had a chance to kind of go through that, so that's the guilty pleasure.
Yeah, I'm salivating as I think about that. I agree that carnivorous and That'll be fun to go out to Brazilian barbecue. We'll add that to the list when a restaurant going is commonplace again for us. A fun fact, we've done some research, and given last night's televised Oprah interview with Prince Harry and with Meghan Markle, and I'm assuming we have sort of the same attendance and following today for this session, but research tells me that you once met Princess Diana when you were 18 years old.
The things that live on the internet forever, right? Okay. Yeah, I did. I went to an English school when I was in Brazil in São Paulo, and I was the equivalent of class president. She and Prince Charles came over to visit Brazil, and she made her way to the school, and I was responsible for sending her off with a hip hip hooray thing, and it was very loud and very noisy. I didn't want to do it, and but I was told by the headmaster that I had to do it, and so I ended up yelling, and she was very close to me, and she put her finger in the ear and she said, "I wish you had told me you were going to do that," but anyways, yeah, that was my experience.
Well, that's outstanding. Again, the internet holds all. Although if it happened now, it would probably be on YouTube, and you know, a picture of the two of you, but your Instagram, you know, your Facebook page. I guess I'm dating myself. No one's on that anymore. But
nope.
All right, fair enough. Well, I now come to our last question of the day. Something that our members like, and I like, and our guests seem to enjoy as well. As we fight our way through this pandemic, as we head towards hopefully a return to what was normal, I've asked each of the guests and CEOs to give us a message of hope, to give our members something positive that we can take with us from today's session that puts a smile on our face and gives us something to look forward to. So I will pose that question to you, as I have all of our guests. If you could give us a message of hope, something that we can hang our hat on and feel good about.
It's been an incredible 12 months for a lot of us, right? Everybody's gone through a lot. Everybody's been tested. I think we're all seeing kind of, whether we call it the light at the tunnel or whatever we want to call it. And I think that, you know, we should embrace this moment where we're going to have an opportunity as leaders to be able to be part of taking decisions where it allow us to all somewhat resume some sort of normalcy. I never like the term essential workers, not because I don't know what it means, but because it felt that it was restricted to a specific group of people in a given situation. And I think what the pandemic has taught us is that we are all essential. Everything we do, everybody from the person who developed the vaccine to the person delivering your Amazon package to the person at the grocery store to, you know, everybody is essential. And I think that we're all going to have to kind of come together, and we're going to have the courage, because it's not going to be like a light switch. We're going to have some flare-ups, you know, even after the vaccine, there might be an additional cases. I think we'll see some additional cases flare up after spring break. And we're going to have the courage to say, you know, we can live with this. We have amazing technology, vaccines, testing, pharmaceuticals. And I guess my message of hope is that as leaders, that we come together and have the courage to be able to use all these tools and make the right decisions so that we can all kind of get back together and get back to some sense of normalcy, because we are all essentials. It's not one group or the other. We're all intertwined, and our work depends on how everybody kind of steps forward. So
that's fantastic. It is sort of a culmination of what we've heard over the past year from our guests. It's this concept of resiliency. It's the sense that we're in this together, right? This is a community, both locally and globally. And the only way we're going to make it through is with everybody lifting each other up to get through this. And knowing that we're going to get knocked down again, but we have to learn how to keep getting up, get knocked down seven times and get up eight. It's always that concept that I'm reminded, because life is not perfect, but the effort needs to be there to keep the ball rolling. So I very much appreciate and enjoy that sentiment and your message of hope. So once again, everybody, I hope you'll join me in thanking our guest today, proud Boston College alum, but more importantly for this discussion, the CEO and president of Abbott, Robert Ford, has joined us here live on campus. Our next event will be on April 5th, PwC's Call to Action for Diversity and Inclusion panel. We'll have a discussion. Information will be shared with you to register and join us for the future. I also have, actually, I should do this quickly. I think we have a small gift back here. I hit it, but on behalf of
the benefit of not doing it via Zoom, I get the gift.
Yes, right. I'm sorry, we're happy to mail it to you. But on behalf of one of our members, Bose, we have a small gift here for you that you can listen to when you're walking your dog next on a Saturday and listening to Pink Floyd. So again, on behalf of Boston College and all of our members, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.